Hi, this is Bonnie Bramlett, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcast with your panties on.
Hey guys, okay, so today I chat with Johnny Eccles, guitarist and founder of one of the greatest bands to come out of LA in the 1960s, and that band is Love. Listening to Johnny, I felt like I was back on the Sunset Strip in 1965. I mean, these guys were the darlings of LA rock, and they performed at all the hot venues on the Strip, and there were a ton of them at the time. So as you'd expect, he's got so many stories to share. And yes, we're going to talk about The Doors and Jim Morrison, but he's also going to talk about the making of their seminal album, Forever Changes. He's going to talk about his early days playing with Little Richard, meeting the Beatles, meeting Jimi Hendrix. There's a lot to cover. I felt so honored to get this time with Johnny, so I hope you enjoy our discussion as much as I did. All right, let's get started. Johnny, thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, I'm fascinated by your music and how you made such a big impact on the LA music scene and influenced so many bands around you. I mean, The Doors essentially wanted to be just like Love.
Yeah.
But I even read, you know, Zeppelin and the Stones. They've referenced Love as an inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is incredible, isn't it? You know, to think that so many people were influenced, people that we didn't even realize that were listening to us, actually, were influenced. But I knew the Stones were because a couple of our tunes, they kind of co-opted, actually three or four of them. So we, I was kind of aware of that, yeah. The song Going Home, we did a song called John Lee Hooker or Revelation, which was, they basically knocked it off. Even with the grunts and the guttural noises that we made, they did the same thing. But Mick had come to the Whiskey and had asked me about the song and asked how it was playing a song. Basically, the whole set, we would play one song. And they cut it down to, I think, 15 minutes. But he was asking how the crowd liked it and the response and all of that. And I told him, yeah, everybody loved it. So about a month before our album was released, they did a version called Going Home, which, as I said, was basically a knockoff. Then they did a song called She Comes in Colors, which we had done. And there are a couple others that I can't recall now. And Madonna has also co-opted some of our stuff from the First Love album. And she finally ended up giving us writer's credit because it was a blatant knockoff. So,
wow. Yeah. But I mean, you have to be flattered.
Yeah, I'm flattered as long as it doesn't affect our bank accounts. I'm flattered.
Yeah. The flattery only goes so far.
That's correct.
Well, let's go back. I want to go back to the beginning here because well before Love and when you guys were kids, because I know that you and Arthur Lee, the lead singer, were childhood friends in Memphis. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. Yes. Actually, our families were friends before our parents were even born. So our families go back together a long way. And our grandparents were school teachers, Arthur's and mine, and then his mother, as well as my mother and my daughter also is a school teacher. So we are a family of teachers. I was like 4 years old, I think, when we met. And Arthur's a couple years older than I am. So he's like my big brother my whole life.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So where did the inclination to start playing music even come from then?
Well, I played with Billy Preston and I went to junior high school and high school together. And we started a group. We were playing bar mitzvahs and weddings, funerals, whatever. And so we were getting a lot of attention, and Arthur saw that. Now, he had been taking accordion lessons since he was a kid. So they didn't have keyboards back then, that, you know, the portable keyboards. You had to have a full-size organ or piano. So his parents brought him one of those Wurlitzer kind of living room organs. And he started playing that. And when Billy left to pursue his gospel career, and Henry Vestine of the Canned Heat was also in that group. So we had a pretty odd group. And Arthur joined and took Billy's place. And it went from there.
And how old were you at this point?
About 14, 15.
About 14 or 15. And you, though, had, I had read somewhere that you had taken lessons, guitar lessons from, and maybe this is true or not true, Adolph Jacobs?
Yes, from the Coasters, yes. Yes, he was my first teacher. So he lived in the neighborhood and he saw me walking with my student guitar and he just said, oh, this is a piece of crap. So he hooked me up with a professional guitar and started giving me lessons. And so, yeah, that was my kind of initiation into playing, because he would take me around to places in the so-called Chitlin circuit, and I'd see all these blues musicians playing, Johnny Guitar Watson and B.B. King and people like that. And it was just from seeing those guys, it was something I knew I wanted to do.
She comes on like a rose, but everybody knows she'll get you in touch. You can look, but you better not touch. Poison ivy, poison ivy.
Your family was very connected in the scene.
Well, yeah, my uncle used to manage a club called the Californian Club. And that was a major stop in that circuit. So when we grew up and got around 15, we were able to play. We were kind of the house band at the Californian Club. So we played behind, B.B. King, ZZ Hill, and the Coasters. Any groups that came there, we were the house band. So we played the music behind them. And so we weren't supposed to play there. So we would pencil in these little mustaches, and I would wear a hat. And it was okay.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, as long as we stayed away from the bar, it was cool. You know, as long as we weren't around the alcohol, they wouldn't get in any trouble having us play on stage. So we got to meet all of these people back then. And you know, they would see us first, me and Billy, but then once they heard us play, they were cool with it. And Little Richard, we played with him a lot and toured with him, actually. So he got to be our mentor as well.
Oh my God. Was it lost on you being so young? What a wonderful opportunity this was, that you were so lucky to be around some of these people.
Oh, absolutely. But after a while, it just became normal. But yeah. In the beginning, of course it was. And meeting all of these famous producers, we met Sam Cooke and J.W. Alexander, his producer and manager, and all of these people. And we played with Bob Keane and we were part of, Glenn Campbell was working with us at Delphi Studio. So we knew all these people. And since we were so young, they tried to keep us kind of isolated from kind of the darker parts of the business. And Glenn Campbell especially. And he didn't, you know, even though he used drugs, cocaine himself, primarily, he would keep us away from that because he, you know, we were kids. So,
yeah.
So it was interesting. Thinking about it now, it's really interesting.
Yeah. And also futile, you know, considering where you guys are.
Yes. It didn't work.
Well, you said you got to meet Little Richard. Did you ever get to work with him?
Yes, I did. We went to England. This would have been, I think, 62, 63. I was still in high school. And we met the Beatles. These guys, they were kind of little, like little puppy dogs, and they followed him around and but they really, really loved him. So yeah, we were on that tour, and Billy, because I had to leave and come back home, but Billy played with them. And then after he got back a few months later, this would have been the Hollywood Bowl appearance, we got tickets. The first time I'd ever seen a courier, and he came with this little briefcase, and he had these backstage passes and tickets for us. So we got to go backstage and see the Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl. So that was neat. When we saw them, then we were home. We knew this is exactly what we wanted to do.
That was your, so to speak, rock moment.
Yes, it was. And then, because before that, I had intended on going to college and becoming a lawyer. And by now I'd be either an ambulance chaser or whatever. But anyway, that's what I planned to do. But when we saw them, that was everything changed.
But you had seen them play with Little Richard, and it sounds like it was a far cry from what you saw at the Hollywood Bowl.
No, I didn't realize the tickets that we got were for the same guys. I didn't know those little guys that followed Richard around were the Beatles. And it didn't, you know, we never found that out until we get there. And I said, those are the little dudes that followed Richard around. And they were the biggest thing on earth, you know, so.
Now you're standing there in the audience and you're hearing all these screaming girls.
Yeah, no, we're backstage with them. And so we're getting to see all of the stuff go on, and we're seeing them, you know, go back and forth and all the mechanisms that go into making an appearance in a show. And it was fascinating seeing how all the techs ran around getting the sound system together, because these guys didn't go to sound check. You know, they'd have someone as a stand-in. So you're watching them and making sure they had all the knobs turned correctly and the levels on the guitar amps were proper. So that was interesting from that aspect, to see all that it required to actually put on the show that they did. And then, of course, all of that was futile, because you didn't hear a word they said or anything. It was just screaming. That's all you heard for the whole rest of the night.
That's what I heard. I read some I don't know what it was, some old article in the magazine back, you know, right when they came to America, and John Lennon had said at times we could have just been making noises or farting and nobody would have known.
That's correct. They could have been, they might have been, but yeah, because they would look at each other, and John was the kind of the impster, the joker, and he would look at Paul and you'd see them winking and making faces at each other. But you know, they It started out, I think, to them as just, they couldn't understand it any more than any of us did. And then as it progressed, they were becoming more and more and more serious with what they did. But I think initially it was something that they were in awe of just as much as everyone else was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because this is a phenomenon.
I mean, it's correct.
Elvis was maybe the closest thing, but it was different. It was different.
Yes, it was. You can't anticipate that. It's just, it happened. And then it just kind of snowballed, and nobody could have predicted that it would go to the degree that it did.
It would become this pop culture shift.
Right, yes, that's what it did. It actually, music in that instance changed the world, because things, the movement that came behind it and the generation, the World War II baby boomer generation were coming of age. And it was at that specific point in time that things just changed, the sexual revolution, the civil rights movements, the Vietnam War, all of those things are happening at the same time.
Right, yeah. Right. It's like within a year.
Yeah.
So fascinating to me. And I want to put a pin in that moment when you knew that this is what you wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I want to jump back to that Little Richard tour really quickly, because was that the tour that Jimi Hendrix came on?
Correct, yes. Yeah. Jimmy was basically his gopher, his man Friday. Jimmy was his chauffeur, his butler, and the guitar player. So he was Jimmy James back then. And we first met Jimmy at the California Club. He sat in with us because he came auditioning to play with the Isley Brothers. And no, he was playing with the Isley Brothers, and he auditioned to play with the OJs. And he didn't get the job. And so he played with us for a while behind other groups. But as I said, he was Jimmy James back then.
He was Jimmy. He wasn't the Jimi Hendrix that we know.
No, by no means was, because I always considered him to be a kind of a mediocre guitar player. He didn't play anything special. And when you're around people like Johnny Guitar Watson or B.B. King, hearing them play, and then hearing Jimmy at that time play, that he was just not in the same league at all. So really? I would never. No. He was just, you would consider him a journeyman guitar player, just an average bar band type of guitar player, because he didn't have all of the effects at that point. He didn't have the distortion and the wah-wah pedal and the chorusing and all the things that went into making Jimmy, and then also the wardrobe, because at the time I knew him, he was kind of down on his luck. And so he had his shoes, he would kind of list at a 45 degree angle because the shoes would be run over. And when, you know, when the heels of your shoes get worn in a certain direction, you kind of list in that direction. And that was him. And he also used right guard copiously, because he couldn't afford to send everything to the cleaners. So you would know Jimmy was coming just by the right guard. Like he could be, you know, maybe half block away and you'd smell the right guard and you'd know. But he was really a nice, nice guy, very quiet, introspective, and not at all the flamboyant person that you saw on stage. That was just a facade. He was, you know, a quiet, intelligent man, and not at all like the wild man that you saw on stage.
Right, burning guitars and all of that.
Yeah, yeah. I always thought that was ridiculous because musicians covet and cherish their instruments, who started that, destroying their instruments? And you know, most musicians can't imagine that. First of all, they're damn expensive to purchase,
yeah.
And then just paying for my amps for years, and I think to destroy it, you know, that just doesn't make any sense.
I've always felt the same way whenever I've seen those performances. I'm like, what a waste, you know? Mm-hmm. People are running for shards of the guitar that they're going to hold on to forever. This yeah. is from Monterey Pop in 67.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I had known. Yes. I would take some of those.
You have a museum.
Really? Yes.
Hey guys, we're going to take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsor. We'll be right back. Okay guys, let's get back to the interview.
Well, that's interesting. It sounds like things changed very drastically for Jimmy with the adoption of the new sounds and technology
mm-hmm.
That he was able to really use to his advantage. And then, of course, the flamboyant wardrobe to go along with
right.
it.
Right, yes.
Wow. Yes. So jumping back to that pin we put in that moment at the Beatles, so you guys decided this is what you want to do. And how did you become Love at that point?
Well, we at first were called the Grassroots. We had seen an Eldridge Cleaver novel. I think it was Up from the Grassroots. And we thought it was kind of a double entendre to name ourselves the Grassroots, you know, being in the whole drug culture and everything. So we were the Grassroots for quite some time. And then we were playing at a club in Hollywood called the Brave New World. And this gentleman named Lou Adler. Now at the time, we had no idea who Lou Adler was. Anyway, he had been drinking and he was with a young lady and he was trying to impress her. So Brian and I were outside and he came up and he said, I've heard you guys several times and I'm going to make you into the next Beatles. And he was just so effusive and what he was going to do for us. And we're kind of quizzically looking at the man. We don't know who he is. And Brian said, well, man, why don't you talk to our manager? Because we have to go back on. And so he thought that Brian, we were basically shining him on. And he goes from being effusive to all of a sudden really pissed off. And how dare you disrespect me like this? You'll never work in this town again. I mean, he just went off on us. And about maybe 2 months later, one of the people that came to us, to the club rather, said they had heard our record. And they said, what record? We don't have a record. And they say, yes, Mr. Jones, it's a Dylan song. And I said, well, no, we didn't do it. And it turns out that Lou Adler had gone to San Francisco and he got together a bunch of studio musicians and they had co-opted our name. He knew, of course, that we were the Grassroots. It's on the billboard there. We played there for months and he'd been in there. So he knew that. But he also knew that because we had a pretty large fan base back then. And if he knew that if our fan base thought that it was our record, they would rush out and buy it, which they did.
Oh,
and huge
yeah.
numbers. And that's what sent, what the hell was that name? The name of the damn thing. Is it Positively 4th Street? I think that's what it is. Anyway, it's the one that, Do You, Mr. Jones?
Okay.
That song. And I'm forgetting the title, the actual title of the song. But anyway, it went up the charts based on the fact that all of these kids from the Valley and Hollywood and Los Angeles rushed down to the stores to purchase it, thinking it was us.
It was you.
Mm-hmm. And so, of course, we talked to lawyers, and they said, because we had the poor man's copyright, which you basically send a registered letter to yourself, and there has the seal on it, and then the judge would open it in court, and the person who had first claim would own the name. But then the lawyers told us we'd probably win in court, but we would piss off one of the biggest men in the business, and we'd be destroying ourselves in the process. So we would be better off getting another name. And so we decided to find another name. And just by happenstance, serendipity, we're driving down the street and we see a billboard for Love Brasiers. And I told Brian, you know, Arthur used to work there in the shipping department. And we started laughing at Arthur and, you know, it having a joke at his expense. And then Brian said, wow, that would be a great name for a group. And right there, we decided we would be Love. Yes.
L-O-V-E.
Yes. It used to be Love Brasiers was L-U-V. And so we decided, we talked about it and said it would be L-O-V-E, of course, with nothing in front of it, just plain Love. And that we were going to trademark and get our name properly legal so that nobody could take it from us. So we did and became Love.
Wow. Great that name.
Much better name than the grassroots anyway.
Well, did you ever have any subsequent conversations with Lou about this?
No. He kind of turns and goes, but we did speak with people in the group and they told us that, yeah, he came up with that name. And then we knew there was a group that we'd heard of called the Grassroots. And he said, never mind, I've worked it out with them. Of course, he'd never spoken to us, but he knew also that we were kids and didn't have the wherewithal really to fight in court. And as I said, even if we had, it would have been a fool's errand to go against one of, you know, somebody so powerful in the industry. So we just let it go. And it turned out to our advantage because it's a much, much better name and has a much cooler cachet to it than Grassroots.
Oh, heck yeah. And this is what, 1965 at this
point? Yes,
1965.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Perfect timing.
Yes, it was. So that was serendipity. Serendipity kind of weaves its way throughout our story because things happened that were just so interesting and just so unusual that it was just like it was destined to be that way.
Yeah, and it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, seems so. We're still here almost 60 years later. We're still 55 years later. We're still at it.
Can you believe it?
I
mean, will there ever be a moment when that actually sets in?
And I don't think it ever will, because I think about it and wow, that's just amazing, especially when we tour and we go to England and then people are chanting my name and there's huge crowds of people and I'm looking at them and I'm just, you know, just amazed by it. That. And it's a younger generation because most people from my generation are transitioning or getting too old to go to tours. But every now and then we'll see some people from back in the day, but mostly it's a whole different generation. And so we somehow appeal to them, which is, you know, amazing to me and on one hand, but not so on the other, because you look at the choices they have. And I think the music from back then, you know, I don't want to get myself into trouble, but the music of today, especially hip hop and some of the other music that techno, especially.
Yeah.
Just to me, it's just noise, you know, that's just what it is to me. I know some people may not like hearing that, but that's what I hear. And music is in the ear of the beholder. And what I behold coming from some of today's music is just like static noise that I would like to get away from as quickly as possible because it's bothering my ears. You know, like we saw Gorillaz the other night. Now they were a fantastic group.
Yeah.
We loved seeing them, but it was so loud and so noisy. And so it's like techno rap, I think. So it had both of the genres that I'm not really that fond on together. And anyway, as
nope,
I said,
I'm
before,
right there with you.
Okay.
I'm right there with you. That's why I have this podcast. That's why I'm talking to people like you, because I have an affinity for this music, you know, and it fascinates me to hear the backstories. But I also have to believe that when you are out there and you are performing across the world, far from LA, and you have generations of people coming to see you, that's got to be incredibly satisfying.
Yes, it is. And to remain relevant at this point in time is just amazing to me. So I just kind of I'm in awe of the fact that it's still going on. So I can't explain it and don't understand it. So
yeah, and don't just go with it.
That's right. I'm going to go with the flow.
At my house, I've got no shackles. You can come and look if you want to. Through the halls, you'll see the mantles where the light shines dim all around you. And the streets are paved with gold. And if someone asks you, you can call my name.
So LA back then, especially the Sunset Strip, we're talking 1965. There's like probably 25 clubs within that 1.6 mile radius,
Yes,
whatever it is. So if you made a name in that area back then, I mean, you really were, you really made a name for yourself, period.
Yes, you did.
So many venues, so many options, so many bands.
And you could support yourself on what a musician earned just playing clubs back then, because that's, there were so many clubs and so many people coming to this one small area on the strip. And we played, basically six nights a week. And then on Sundays, we played matinee. So we were playing every day and we played four sets. So they would empty the club out and bring in a new crowd after each set. So we would play with four different crowds a night, six nights a week and the matinees on Sunday. And we did that for the longest time. So you establish a name for yourself and you establish a following. So it's like the Birds, Buffalo Springfield, the Doors, and Iron Butterfly. We were all playing these clubs and you establish a following and that follows you into your recording career. And it's a really huge boost, you know, because your records will just automatically just start selling just from the fact from this small area. And that gets you on the charts. And, you know, once you're on the charts, it's kind of like a snowball effect. Other people buy the record and other radio stations pick it up because it's hot in this area. So they start playing it and it becomes hot there as well. So yeah, this was the place that made everybody. And it was, you know, a point in time that I don't think can ever occur again, because you had all of those things happening at the same time, as I mentioned before. So
right. And the music industry's changed. It's just not set up the same way.
Yeah, so. No, it's not. It's, you got corporate people. Back then you had people that were interested in the music for the sake of music. And we never intended or thought we would get rich playing music, just wanted to earn a living. But everybody did the very best that they could. And we were each trying to outdo the other. You know, there was this friendly, competitive nature. And you hear the Doors had something, so you wanted to do something better. And that's just how people felt. And it wasn't about the money. It was about the music.
Right. And were you all playing essentially like musical clubs? I mean, jumping from like musical chairs, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Brave New World, but you played kind of all over, right?
Yes, we did. And so did they. We would play at the Whiskey A Go Go one night and then the Doors would be there. Or we'd play actually a couple of weeks and then the Doors would play there. And then Iron Butterfly or the Buffalo Springfield. And you had all of these groups. We lived in the same street next door to each other. So I can name Frank Zappa, Janis Joplin, the Birds, the Doors, Iron Butterfly, Buffalo Springfield. All of us lived right next to each other.
In Laurel Canyon.
In Laurel Canyon, yeah. We're within a few houses of each other, yeah.
And so you were all visiting each other. You were all sharing music, sharing lyrics to each other. I didn't want to say it, Johnny, but you know.
Well, yes, because in the scene from the clubs, we'd go from the clubs and go to somebody's house and the scene would continue. And all the young ladies that would be at the clubs would now be at one of those houses, and we were kids and that revolution was happening. So of course it was just a natural thing. It was not something that, and because you most of the times didn't even know each other's name. Well, they knew our names, but didn't necessarily know theirs. And it wasn't like it was anybody was being used or anything. It was just young people experiencing life, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And how long were you in Laurel Canyon? Because I know you guys then moved to the castle in Los Feliz.
Yeah, and then we moved back to Laurel Canyon. So off and on there several years. But yeah, the castle was a whole other place, you know, this humongous. We called it the castle, but it was kind of, it was an estate that Norma Talmadge owned. She was a silent screen actress. And she moved to Paris. And a friend of Brian's father managed the property, and it was becoming derelict because it was a humongous place and it had guest quarters and all of these grounds and all of that. And so all we had to do was basically pay the taxes, which back then were not nearly as much as they would be now, because the place, I think Vera Wang has restored it and it's like $15 million. But when we had it, it was offered to us for $50,000. And when my dad said, it's too much work, you don't want this, because the place was, you know, we each had little wings of it that had suites of apartments in it, but it was kind of funky and it could have used a bit of work. But yeah, so it's on YouTube if people ever want to see it. It's called The Castle, and they can go and see it and see Arthur giving the grand tour. But you have to remember what Arthur is showing you is not the place we lived in, because this is a gilded place that has all these fine Persian rugs and beautiful. It didn't look like that when we lived.
It was a little run down.
It was rough. It was a hippie pad. We had the mattresses on the floor and beads hanging instead of curtains. That's how it looked. But it was the Taj Mahal. It was our house. We lived there. And everybody coveted there. So everybody that came to play in Los Angeles with all of the people, Jefferson Airplane, Big Brother, they would come and stay there with us.
They'd stay there with you guys.
Yes, because it had almost 90 rooms, I think, on all. So there was enough room for everybody.
Oh my God. So if those walls could talk.
Yeah, I think we'd all be in jail if they could.
That is so great. I think I've walked by it a couple of times.
Yeah, it's a neat place. You know, she does a lot of tours now because the fact that Jimmy stayed and Janis Joplin stayed there with us. So they have that sort of part of the rock and roll history tour, and people will go by and look at it.
Is so great. And I wasn't aware that you moved back to Laurel Canyon and that you were in such close proximity. I knew that maybe you had stayed with Frank Zappa for a while.
No, he was right down the street. He was like two doors down from me. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so we knew each other. And he was the guy that told us and warned us to stay away from drugs, because he was a teetotaler. He didn't drugs or alcohol. And nobody listened to Frank. Everybody thought that we knew more than he did because he was older than us. And, you know, so we kind of poo-poo him and, you know, shine him on, basically. And so everybody had to experiment and find out for themselves what he knew. And I think how much life, how this country would be different if those people, if we had listened to him, because there were Jimi Hendrix, Morrison, Janis Joplin, Henry Vestine, so many people would still be here and they still would contribute to, you know, the culture and to music. And things would be quite different musically, I think, had we listened to Frank Zappa. He proved prescient.
Yeah. Unfortunately, some of those lessons, right, we have to learn by doing.
Yes. We were kids. Kids have to be kids and learn their own way. And so we learned.
Where are you walking? I've seen you walking. Have you been there before? Walk down your doorsteps. You'll take some more steps. What did you take them for? There's a private in my boat, and he wears this instead of medals on his coat. There's a chicken in my...
I want to talk to you about the whiskey.
Okay.
Because when you started playing there, I know there was a reluctance.
Yeah, because these guys were cops from Chicago, and they were kind of shady cops from Chicago. And they came there and they opened this nightclub, and they had the reputations for not paying you and threatening you when you went to get paid. And so Ronnie Heron, now Ronnie Mellon, she married into the Chase family, the Chase banking family. But then she was Ronnie Heron. And she was the booker, and she worked there at the club. And she booked us and guaranteed that we'd get paid. She said, I'll pay you myself if you have any problems. So we played there for 2 weeks, and we actually got paid, and the check didn't bounce. And so that happened, and we told everybody else that, yeah, this is cool. They actually will pay you, and it's cool. And they turned out to be very, very nice. We knew them for until Mario just passed recently, a year or so ago. But we knew them for all those years, and they were good people. And they booked just about everybody who ever played in Hollywood or that were on the charts at the Whiskey. It became the end spot. And as I said, everybody got paid. So it worked out.
And in terms of Ronnie Heron, was it you guys or was it her that essentially discovered the Doors next door at the London Fog and brought them over?
Well, we knew the Doors because we all knew each other. So Morrison used to get drunk and just fall asleep in my doorway. I'd come out and stumble over him. So he had a problem with drink.
But in your doorway? Was he knocking on the door trying to get in?
Or no, that was just
he wanted to be close to you?
It was kind of a little alcove. Yeah, he wanted to be like us. That was the thing that he wanted more than anything. He'd said that many times, but he would sleep in the alcove leading up to the door. And we had been offered a tremendous sum of money to switch record companies to go to MCA. And we knew Elektra was not going to let us go because we were their ticket into the game. You know, that was a huge cachet that they had love. And so they could sign other people on the strength of that. And so they were not going to let us go under any circumstance. But we thought, we knew that when Jim was on his game and performing the way he should and could, that these guys were a force to be reckoned with. They were, even though they sounded like a lounge act to us because they didn't have a bass, he just had this magnetism that you could see. And you could see all of these young girls there standing up looking at him. And so we thought, why don't we hook Elektra up with the Doors? And so we did, because Jim had been asking us, you know, for months and months to introduce him, and nobody wanted to vouch for him because we knew that he was unpredictable. But we finally did, and Jack Holzman came from New York to see them, and Jim was of course drunk, and he hated them, and he just, you know, got pissed off at us for even bringing him here to see them.
And
wasting his time. So we got him to come back again. He was here for something. He came back and saw him the second time and hated him even more. So a few months go by and he's here, and we're doing an album, the Capo, our second album, and he introduces us to a gentleman named Paul Rothschild. Now, we knew nothing about Paul Rothschild, only that he had just gotten out of prison for selling grass. And so to us, that was cool. So we hired him on the strength of that. And he took Jack Holzman on our recommendation to see the Doors the third time. And Jack just said, I want you to see these guys yourself. And so we can just stop having us come down here and look at them. And this time they were playing with the Iron Butterfly. So the competitiveness took over. Jim wasn't drunk. He was in his element and he put on a clinic. And they saw what we saw. All of these young girls are in there in awe of him. And Ronnie Heron introduced them to the Door. She was the one that she was supposed to get a percentage, of course, for making the introduction. But as would happen in the record business, those details were forgotten. So I think she had to go to court and sue them. But anyway, she introduced them and the Door signed with them. And Paul Rothschild was their producer. And so as we're doing Da Capo, they're recording their first album at Sunset Sound.
Wow. And here's my question, hearing this story. In the times that you brought Jack Holzman to see them, did you ever go to Jim and say, hey, buddy, we're trying to help you out here. You've asked to be introduced. Maybe clean it up a little bit tonight.
Yes, but when he was real dyed-in-the-wool alcoholic. I mean, he couldn't help himself. And he probably had a couple of fits of something every single day of his life until he died. And yeah. So there, you could tell him, you could talk to him. When you're sitting there talking to him before he started, he's perfectly fine and normal and rational and a very intelligent man. But by 11 o'clock at night, I mean, he's just, you know, he's totally blithered. And the group would have eventually, because they were on the verge of breaking up at that point. So had Elektra not signed them, there would have been no Doors. So it was just that because of the fact that the Iron Butterfly were playing on the same bill, and it's just pride, ego, whatever, just caused him to come down and do it properly. I don't think he even knew at that point that the record company was coming there, because I think it was a surprise to us that they would come back the third time. But this time, as I said, I brought Paul Rothschild with him, and Paul could immediately see what we had been telling him.
And the minute that they saw what you had been telling them, they had that swagger. You thought, okay, we're out. We're on to bigger and better.
That's what we thought, because you see, Elektra Records was a new company. Basically, they were a folk label. And we signed with them initially because they were the only, we had entreaties from Capitol, Columbia, Decca, and Warner Brothers to sign. But none of them would allow us to own the publishing and own our masters. And Elektra did. They said, you can own the publishing. So we did own the publishing to our stuff, which was rare back then. But I'd learned that from Little Richard. He kind of schooled it into me that you should own your own music. Don't ever let them take your music from you, because he had gone through that, where all these songs that he wrote, somebody else put their names next to his, or they got most of the money. And, you know, he'd get a new car or something and not get paid. So he kind of drummed that into me. And so, you know, I paid attention to him. He was someone that I respected so much that I paid attention to him. And so we kept the publishing. And that was the reason we signed with this unknown folk label, Elektra. MCA, on the other hand, was a huge company that could get us into all of the record stores, where Elektra had problems initially getting our records into all of the record stores. So I think our first couple of records went to the 30s, or I think one went as high as the 20s on the charts, but it couldn't go any further because their distributorship wasn't able to get our records into places in the Mid-America and the South, which MCA could, because they had all the pull and the money and the resources to do that. Now, of course, Elektra, once the Doors had a huge hit, all of those things opened up for them, and they were able to get those records because they had a kind of a distributorship deal with a larger record company to get them into, I think it was the EMI and they were able to get the records, especially overseas, where we had problems. Even though we had a humongous following in Europe, many times they couldn't get our records. They had to order them by mail or something, rather than them being in the record store. So anyway, that was what we thought, and nothing happened except, you know, we ended up kind of on the back burner because the money and resources that would be spent to promote Love was now being used to support and promote the Doors. So their tours and getting on Ed Sullivan and all of those things were just, you know, we were on the back burner. So we played, you know, Dick Clark and American Bandstand and Where the Action Is and local shows, but we didn't get the huge national breakout. And that was because we had basically shot ourselves in the foot by, you know, insisting that they sign the Doors, who had now become humongous, you know. And of course, they're business people, and they know where the money is now, you know, or actually is waiting for them. In other words, because, you know, initially, of course, they're not making a huge sum, so they have to borrow money against the Doors, and, you know, they're not going to spend that money on us. So anyway, we made a childish kid's decision, thinking that, you know, this kind of wishful thinking, and it didn't work out. That's the best way I can put it.
Sure, sure. If you had to do it over, though, would you have gone with another label that didn't grant the publishing rights?
No. We would have not introduced them to the Doors, even though they were our friends and we loved them and were really proud of their success. It was a poor business decision. Friendship-wise, it was great, but business-wise, it was a dumb decision.
Yeah. Again, you learn by doing, right?
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah, come on.
And how did you feel about Jim? I always love talking to people that knew him personally and what their real take was.
He became different as the fame. He became kind of, well, actually the first, when we got him to sign with Elektra, the first thing they did, or Jim did, was to go in and trash the president's office. I mean, that's the kind of respect he showed us after doing it. But we realized he couldn't help himself. So he goes in the record company's president's office and just totally destroys it. That was his opening salvo to let them know that.
Yeah. Yes. A glimpse of what was to come.
That's correct. And he was a handful. He just, I think the drink had just kind of affected his mind to the point that he could not help himself. And I don't think it would have been possible for him to clean up. I think he was so, because he had been an alcoholic for so long that I don't think there was any hope of him changing, because that was who he was, you know. And he had this thing of shocking people. You know, he would just go to a friend's house and put his cigarette out on their rug or do crazy stuff like that, or drop his pants and, you know, go into a room full of people and, you know, just be completely just insensitive and rude. But that he just did that because he thought that was how a rock musician was supposed to act. You know, I guess just, you know, you saw all of the stuff that later musicians were doing, it like trashing hotel rooms and doing all that crap. I think he just thought that was, you know, what he was supposed to do.
That's too bad.
Well, yeah, it's too bad. And, you know, the thing that I never understand is we all work very hard to get to the point where we're successful and drawing large audiences and making money. So why would you destroy that? Why, after finally making it, which most of us ended up doing, and that's something that a psychologist could probably make a fortune if he could figure it out. Oh, we all did the same thing. We got as high as we could to destroy everything that we'd worked all of that time to build.
Yeah.
And it's baffling to think you finally get it. You've got the brass ring. And what do? You do everything you can to tear that brass ring into pieces.
Throw it away.
Throw it away.
You feel like you don't deserve it or something.
I think maybe that is, you know, you think of yourself as a fraud or something, because there are other people, you know, that are going off to that awful war and dying. You're getting notices that friends are dying, and you're living the life of Riley, and you kind of, you know, guilt is kind of there. Yeah.
Yeah. Why me and not him?
That's correct. Because it very easily could have been just a couple of different decisions, you know, could have changed everything around, and you could be over there in the godforsaken jungle rather than them.
Yeah, especially back then. It's a very scary time.
Yeah, because they were just coming and picking you up. We know friends that went down one day and the next day they were being shipped over to Vietnam. You know, and so we were just fortunate that our numbers came up at a time when we could play them because we learned the game. You go down and you pretend to be just as ignorant and recalcitrant and uncooperative as you can be. You make sure you don't take a bath for a couple of weeks before going in there. So you're repulsive. And just want you away. They want you out of there. So you get, you know, that's how we all did it, because we all had, David Crosby had told us, because he found out from someone else that that's what to do. And that's what we did. They would give you directions. You go over here and you would end up going over there, or you would pretend you can't hear them. You would do whatever it is to make them realize that, that this person just is not amenable to being in services. So they would send us home. And so that's how we got out. But then later on, they got on to it. And they realized that so many of these people from Hollywood come down and they're playing, basically doing the same thing, the same act. And they realized that's what it was. It was an act, a planned act to get out of going. So they that was no longer appropriate. And so they allowed people even that were as, you know, horrible as we were, they were still taking them. At that point, they needed bodies and they didn't care. They would take anybody. Wild Man Fisher, I think, if you know who he is. And Wild was, you know, anyway, he was on the bus. And I think he got down there. And before he got out of basic training, they shipped him back. So they realized he was the real deal. He was actually a schizophrenic. We were pretending to be, he actually was.
He actually was that person you did not want to be in the trenches with.
That's correct.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, so you're, all right, so you got out scot-free. You're back in LA. You did Da Capo. And then now you're planning for Forever Changes.
Correct.
Talk to me about the making of that album, because when I listen to Forever Changes, I mean, obviously, I'm echoing the sentiments and the thoughts that everybody else have been saying for the last however many decades. That album is beyond exceptional. And every song is so different. What went into that?
The word serendipity, I use that. And that, again, was how that, because the album initially was a totally different album. We were kind of getting pissed off, Brian and I, because, see, Arthur was a wonderful wordsmith and poet, but he was not very much of a musician, not very good at all. And he didn't play on any of our stuff. So basically, Brian and I and Kenny, we're writing the music to all of these songs, and we're not getting the recognition that we know that we deserve for that. So we're getting pissed off. So finally, we work it out. We're going to do a double album, Forever Changes. So Brian would have one side for his material, I'd have one side, and Arthur would have the two sides of the record. So that's what we worked toward. So we worked almost a year on these songs, and we had great songs ready to go. And we get to the studio, and we find out at the very last minute that Elektra Records said it was too expensive to do a double album, and that we'd do the other part later. So it'd be a totally different album. And there was just, you know, really, really, really hard feelings. And Brian staged a kind of a mutiny. You know, he just wouldn't play Arthur's songs that way, the way he had normally played them. So we go to the studio the first time, and it's just a mess, you know, because it doesn't sound like us. We're all pissed off. And so we ended up canceling the rest of the sessions. We come back, and Neil Young is there as a producer now. Neil Young is our friend. We hang with him, get high with him. There's no way in hell we're going to listen to Neil Young as a producer. So we get upset again and walk out. But this time we're walking out basically laughing, because it, to us, it was, why of all people would they bring Neil Young? And Bruce Botnick was also friends with Neil. And at that time, Neil was on the verge of being kicked out of his apartment because he was flat broke. And so Bruce Botnick thought that he would, for producing a couple of songs, he would get a producer's percentage. And of course, as I said, we were having none of that. And so I think he was paid for one day for coming in, but he produced nothing. And then we were on the verge of just walking away from the project totally. And then Elektra, kind of wiser minds prevailed. You know, as I said, they had brought in studio musicians to try to do that. So they brought in the Wrecking Crew. And the Wrecking Crew played on one or two songs. And then they realized that these guys are fantastic musicians, but they don't sound like us. And so they were going to just cancel the project altogether. And then we had a talk and decided, is this how we want to go out? Do we just want to just fizzle like this? And so we decided that we would go back into the studio and play the songs properly, which we did, and work out all of the other problems later. And we did that. And the record just, you know, flowed smoothly from there. We finished it in a few days. And
can you imagine if you didn't do the record? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but then the seeds for our ultimate demise were sown at that point, because Brian and Jack Holtzman had worked out a deal surreptitiously. We didn't know that he had worked out a deal with Brian to do a solo project. Now, Brian, of course, is going to stay with the group, but he was going to get to do his record, the one that was supposed to be part of Forever Changes, now called If You Believe In. He was going to get to do it separately. Now, none of us knew that. And so Brian calls me and tells me that he'd worked out this deal. And I said, you mean while we were on tour in New York and Jack is winding us and dining us, you work out a deal with him, but you don't tell us. And yeah, that's how it happened. So I said, let's go and tell Arthur the good news. And I kind of knew exactly what was happening. And so we went over to Arthur's house, and Arthur said, oh man, that's fantastic, Brian. I'm so happy for you. You're fired. And so Brian was fired immediately. And that was basically that. And we went our separate ways for a couple of months. We decided, or Arthur realized that it wasn't happening, because he would go to places and play, and instead of having lines around the corner, he was barely able to get, you know, 20 people to show up. So he realized that now it wasn't just him, that it was in fact a group. And so he invited us all to come back together, and we worked it out and signed agreements with each other about payment and all of that. And except for Brian, he refused to come back. So we played a few gigs. We played the Santa Monica Civic and a few others. And it just wasn't the same without Brian. He had this look and this kind of persona that fit the group. And without him, it was a different group. So we decided at that point to go our separate ways for real. And that's basically how it ended, just like that, over something that happened that wasn't really that big a deal. Because if he had talked to us and said, yeah, Jack said, I can do my project as a separate project, and you can do yours as a separate project, rather than the Forever Changes being a double album. Had we known that and talked it out, it would have worked out fine. But when you go behind each other's backs and do things like he did, the bond of trust is gone. And so that was enough. We couldn't work it out, you know, and it was over. We had been friends, had, you know, wore each other's clothes because we were the same size, basically. So we shared clothing, lived in the same house. We shared friends, girls. And you just don't do that to your friends. You don't go behind their backs and work out a deal without telling them.
You know? Right.
So anyway, we never could come to a meeting of the minds. And we tried several times to put Humpty Dumpty back together, but, you know, it was irretrievably broken. So that until Arthur and I decided, when Arthur got out of jail prison, actually, for brandishing a firearm. That was sometime in the 90s. I'll go back. We were offered a really huge sum of money by Rhino Records. They did a box set, love box set, to go on tour. So we all agreed to get back together and tour. And then, unbeknownst to us, Arthur had this thing for brandishing a weapon. And he was... it was supposed to be nothing, because friends in our group, especially one of our, he's now a Superior Court judge, but at the time he had connections and he could have helped him. to get a proper attorney, and that would have gone away because it turned out to be really the case was overturned on appeal because he should never have been convicted in the first place. But it took 6 years of his life before it finally was. And then we get together, we're going to tour. And then, as I said, Arthur's gone. And then we talk about it again. And then Brian is giving an interview, talking to someone about it. And he just drops dead. That was at Christmas Day, Christmas Eve, excuse me, in 99.
He's talking to somebody about it and then literally drops dead.
Drops dead. Yeah, it's like a kind of like a slapstick comedy routine where you drop and fall in your plate of food. Basically, that's what he did. And Brian was known for his sense of humor. So, I mean, the interviewer thought he was playing, but he obviously wasn't. He had gained a little weight, but he didn't. He was healthy and bouncy and laughing, and it's just his heart gave out.
But you still decided to press on with Arthur.
Yes, when Arthur got out, these people in the group called Baby Lemonade, they had known our music and had been playing our music for years. And so they played it as well, if not better than we did, actually. And so we got together with them, and we had strings and horns, and we reproduced the Forever Changes album on stage flawlessly. And if you listen to it, it's really hard to tell the difference from the album to the live concerts. And we went everywhere doing that until Arthur passed. And it was his wish as well as mine that we continue. So we continue doing it, and we tour all of the world still. And we just came back from UK and Scotland and Ireland and London we played, and Liverpool. And we will be going back next year to finish the tour.
Johnny, that's incredible.
Yes, it is. And we played just before the pandemic in Sefton Park in Liverpool, and we had over 87,000 people showed up. So
what?
Yeah. So we have a huge crowd of young folks that have discovered love.
I mean, that's got to be just the best feeling. We talked about it a little bit in the beginning, yes. But like, I mean, to draw a crowd like that, are you going to be in LA anytime soon?
Yes, we will be. Well, we'll be playing in Costa Mesa. I think that next month we'll be playing at a club in Costa Mesa. And then we will be going back up to San Francisco the first of the year, and we'll be playing at the Chapel. We've played there a bunch of times. It's a huge venue. I think it used to be a church. And they block off the street during COVID, actually. That was just when COVID was ending. And they put the tables in the street so that people could be distanced from each other.
I love that. Well, if you're playing anywhere near LA, Costa Mesa is close enough. I'm going to come see you guys.
Cool. That
would be an absolute trip. And what are some of the favorite songs that you love, or the songs that really garner, you know, a reaction from the audience when you're out there?
Well, they like You Set the Scene most, I think, because it has so many changes and such a pretty song. But my favorite would be the rock songs, like A House Is Not a Motel, and Your Mind and We Belong Together, because I have really long guitar solos and I have fun playing them. So the guitar player in me comes out and I get to stretch out, and that's fun.
Johnny, what a life you've led.
Yep, it's been fun.
60 years, that's a pretty good run. I mean, that's right up there with the Stones.
Yep, that's a pretty good run. Yep, doing it since we were kids and still doing it. So it's amazing. And I'm in awe of the fact that people will, you know, spend their money and come out even during the pandemic, when it was, as I said, toward the end of the last year. And they came out, and people come wearing their masks, so they show their vaccination cards, and, you know, just to come and see our group play, which is just amazing. You know, I don't understand it. It's, you know, kind of baffles me. But, you know, I know the music is good, but there's something else happening, which, you know, will have to be defined by someone other than myself, because I just don't know.
Well, and I think during the pandemic, we felt so separated from each other, and music has always been the great unifier. So if you're going to brave the crowds, I can't think of a better way to do it than walking into a room and, you know, communing with people who feel the same way about something that you do.
Absolutely.
But like I said, I'll be there. I'd love to see you guys. That'd be so great. I'm so glad you came on. You are a wealth of stories.
It's been my pleasure. And to paraphrase Jerry Garcia, it has been a long, strange trip, and I hope it continues for a while.
Times I've waited patiently for you, and you'll do just what you choose to do.
That was Alone Again, or I love that song. Johnny, thank you so much for coming on My Rock Moment. And guys, I put a link to Baby Lemonade's website in the show notes so that you can stay tuned for any upcoming show dates and you can see Johnny perform live. And I also posted a YouTube video link that provides a tour of the castle in Los Feliz that Johnny was talking about, where love once lived. It's all spruced up now, but oh my gosh, what an incredible property. All right, so as always, don't forget to rate on Spotify, subscribe on Apple, and then follow me at LA Woman Rocks on Instagram. We will see you at the next episode. And in the meantime, guys, have a happy, happy holiday.